We're going to call the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance meeting to order. First order of business is to recognize Tony Albright's father, Denny Albright, who provided every committee for the House of Representatives with a new gavel and sounding board. These gavels are made out of black walnut that are over the board that they were made from. They've been sitting in a barn in Blue Earth County for over 60 years. So this is this wood is well over 100 years old black walnut from the Blue Earth County area. And he put these together because he didn't like these little tiny ones or the way they sound. So they do sound a lot better.
Much better.
So. I will be putting a little card together to send him, and I'd like if every member of the committee would be willing to sign it. Thank you. We'll start with the roll call.
Johnson.
Here.
Lomer.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Becker Finn.
Here.
Considine. Dean.
Here.
Frankie.
Here.
Grossel. Howe.
Present.
Lucero. Neuberger. O'Neill, Pinto,
here.
Uglum,
yeah.
Ward,
here.
Zerwas,
here.
Go ahead.
Representative Ward, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes?
Yes, sir, I have, and I would move the minutes from April 11th.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. We'll start out today with House File 3258, Representative Scott. Members, as the last things for this week, I'd appreciate if we could get done on time today. We do have a number of bills to go, but I believe that we can get done by 11:45 and. Let's see if we can do that. Okay. Representative Scott, I believe you have a couple amendments.
Yes,
well,
Mr.
First
Chair.
Of all, I'll move the bill be laid over. First, I believe you have the A2 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment. I can speak to that if you'd like, or
the A2. Can you briefly explain the A2?
Sure. The A2 just states who can perform the audits for the ALPR and body camera audits. And it also talks about on the second page of the A2, there was a change in language there from who oversees the audit reports from the Commissioner of Administration to the governing body with jurisdiction over the budget of the law enforcement agency.
Are there any questions on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Then we also have the A3 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A3, in talking with law enforcement and the League of Minnesota Cities, they let us know that not all of the body camera technology for doing the audits has the current capability of recording the law enforcement purpose for accessing the data. And so this is removing that section out of the bill.
Okay. Any questions on the amendment by the members? All those in favor of the A3, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Scott, go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is an adjustment to the ALPR, the Automatic License Plate Reader, and body camera auditing language, now that we've begun receiving our first round of audits from the ALPRs. There was much inconsistency in what we received. The current language requires law enforcement departments to provide a summary of the audit. We had submissions from a single page that said, yes, they're in conformity or compliance, to more thorough audits that went section by section of the law and laid out the compliance of each section. And so the Data Practices Commission took up the subject of the audits and recommended that we make adjustments to the ALPR language. We didn't get to the body camera language, but I put that in this bill as well, thinking that it was the perfect time to better align the language between the two technologies where possible, so that we're establishing consistency in statute. And the hope is that there will be less confusion when it comes time to do the body camera audits. There was some confusion because there was some vagueness in the current language of the ALPR audits. So in the bill before you, we've removed the vague language, hopefully, and given law enforcement more direction on what's expected from the audits and the audit reports. So we're hoping to lessen the confusion now that the body camera audits are starting to become due as well. I'll just go over some of the highlights. I have worked with law enforcement and the League of Minnesota Cities on tweaking some language. The first change is on page one regarding the public log of use. The new language requires the public log of use to include HIT data that identifies the number of plates of vehicles that identify stolen vehicles, where the vehicle had an outstanding warrant for their arrest, or where the owner had a suspended, revoked, or canceled driver's license. The bill also clarifies what constitutes an independent audit, clarifies when the audits are due, clarifies what must be included in an audit report and what additional information must accompany the audit report. One of those things is just whatever the agency's policy is. Each agency will have their own policy on ALPR and the body camera as well. And so we want a copy of the policies to accompany the reports. And then it changes what is due to the Commissioner of Administration and the legislature from a summary, just the what could be construed as a one-pager, to a report, an actual report. It also clarifies when a law enforcement agency must notify the Bureau of Apprehension that it has purchased ALPR devices, as well as when they begin to actually use it, because they're not always one in the same date. The bill then explains that if the commissioner believes the agency is not in full compliance, they can order an agency to arrange for additional independent audits. That's of the ALPR. On the bottom of page 3 is where the language explaining the ALPR data and who can access it, and there is similar language in the section related to the body camera data, as we are seeking consistency again in policy for various law enforcement surveillance technology. The sections of the bill that relate to body camera audits begin at the bottom of page 4, and again, it requires role-based access to the data, as well as a public data audit trail. The remainder of the language explains what must be contained in and accompany the audit reports for the body cameras. And that's a summary of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any testifiers?
I believe there are testifiers here.
Okay, we'll see. Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm the Legislative Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. Thank you for hearing this bill today. We very much support the bill's efforts to strengthen the audit requirements for both ALPR and body cam data use and access. The use of these technologies by law enforcement for surveillance purposes has been controversial, to say the least, and a major point of compromise as we've worked through this over the years has been the continued review of the programs through biennial audits, which provide much-needed information to both the general public and to this body. So I think this really cleans some concerns up that we had, and we think this will strengthen our ability to know what's going on with these programs going forward for better accountability. And for all those reasons, we very much support this, and I'm happy to answer any questions anyone might have.
Jeff Pott. Good morning, Chief Potts.
Good morning.
You state your name for the record and proceed.
Chair, Jeff Potts. I am the police chief in the city of Bloomington, but also here representing the Minnesota Chiefs Police Association. And I have Bill Hutton here with me as well.
Welcome.
Well, welcome and thank you. Thank you to Representative Scott for working with us as we fully agree that we needed to come back and try to add some clarity to the audit piece and try to further clarify words like independent which when we created this law a few years back, I think we thought we were pretty clear, but what we found out through the first round of audits, we fully recognized that there were some inconsistencies in how some of the words were interpreted and some inconsistencies in how some of the audits were done, and so fully agree that we needed to come back and try to do some cleanup. We are supportive of these efforts to try to clean this up and work on kind of adding some clarity. We have two areas where we would like to express some concern with the hopes that we can continue to work through that concern and get to a point where we think we're accomplishing the intent in terms of clarifications and appropriate level of transparency, but also creating a system with regard to LPR and body cameras where law enforcement can fully comply in a way that is going to work for all parties involved. And because these are new technologies, we're somewhat kind of trying to figure out where we're going before these systems are fully built and fully rolled out in many communities. So I will try to address one area, and then Mr. Hutton will address the second area. I'm going to talk just real briefly about amendment, lines 5.11 through 5.13. This is an area where it discusses the audit trail, and I guess the feeling from our folks is that the audit that is required biennially should be the tool that demonstrates compliance to the law. It's a very thorough audit. A very expensive audit, and it's a time intensive for the staff of the departments that are choosing to use both LPR and body cameras to work through and really demonstrate compliance to the law. I think it's unlike many other audits in how in-depth it is, and we think that that is the tool that is in place to guide departments on compliance, improve and demonstrate compliance. 5.11 through 5.3 goes a step further and really creates and makes public audit trails of, for example, accesses to video. What we're concerned about is this sensitive data being released through an audit trail has the, I think, a real good chance of clouding public perception and public opinion about the reasons for views or access to body camera video and without appropriate context. So you could have a scenario where data request comes in to show the accesses or views to data, and hundreds if not thousands of those pieces of video perhaps have no views or one. And then there are several that theoretically could go through the prosecution phase and have 20 or more views, and if you're only showing that in summary data, right, the number of views, it gets very hard in a bulk setting to try to add context to that, and we think it could confuse people. We are not at all afraid to explain why a piece of video was viewed, but releasing it in this format, we think the audit of your use of the system will flesh out any inappropriateness, but this has a good chance of being very confusing, probably could be taken out of context, and not ultimately end up with further trust and confidence in the organization. And so we have concerns about, and we think we can work through those if there's a willingness to have some more conversations about that. But in that section, creating more public data on the audit trail, we have some concerns about that.
Welcome to the committee. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Bill Hutton from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. We are in step with the chiefs on this as well, and we appreciate the representative's willingness to have more conversation, hopefully, on this as well. Our concerns have to do with 1.21 and 1.22, where it says a certified independent or internal auditing department or political subdivision, which is not located within the law enforcement agency's jurisdiction. We understand and completely agree that one law enforcement agency should not do an audit of another law enforcement agency, but there are independent audit departments within counties that can be completely independent of the audit from the law enforcement personnel. Excuse me. As already been spoke of and demonstrated, some of these audits can be very expensive. We're getting bids, some sheriff's agencies were getting bids that were up to $20,000 for audits. And we use the state auditor, which was, or some have used, or one has used the state auditor, which would fall within this, which was great. But the issue is expense again. We're talking anywhere between $5,000 and $20,000 for these audits. And having an independent audit department separate from a law enforcement agency is where we would like to see some of this go. So we would, again, with the chiefs, appreciate additional conversation on it.
Thank you. Any questions from members?
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Scott, for bringing this forward. I'm just kind of reviewing the fiscal note, and can you kind of explain what additional burden there'll be upon the Department of Administration and why they need additional funding to enact this?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Neill. I don't think they're going to incur any extra expense. I know that they argue that in that fiscal note. My belief is that we've made so many changes in this with the bill before you that there's going to be so much more clarity that they're not going to have – I mean, they're going to know whether someone's in compliance or not. And the other backup is that these reports also come to the legislature. So their concern was that they don't have to be on their anyone on their staff with an auditing background. And I don't think it's – I think they're making it more complicated than it needs to be. I've seen these audit reports, and it's pretty abundantly clear if they're in compliance or not. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any follow-up? Any public testimony on this bill? Hey, Representative Scott, any final comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just want to address some of the concerns of the previous two testifiers. I'll take the second concern first. The independent audit, we had an occasion, and I don't remember if it was that Minneapolis audited, their auditor audited Hennepin County Sheriff, or it was the other way around. I just believe that there should be more of a degree of separation there. It would allow, if Hennepin County Sheriff's Office wants Ramsey County auditor to audit, then that's fine. I just feel like it was too close of a relationship, and that's why the language is as it is. Secondly, with the concern of the audit trail, you know, one of the reasons that I worked really hard on these bills when these technologies were coming on board is because there were issues where law enforcement was looking at people's personal data without a law enforcement purpose. Anne-Marie Rasmussen, I've got the article right here of how many times, you know, she was a former cop, and how many times her information had been looked up. And supposedly it was because she was into bodybuilding now, and other officers were looking at her information. It was hundreds of times that it was being accessed. And with something as sensitive, with as sensitive as information on it as body cam data, I think it's really important that we have an audit trail so that we know how many times a particular tape has been accessed. If it's been accessed because the case is being prosecuted, then they can note that. But I think this is one of the ways that we've got to have some accountability with something that is could be potentially so sensitive of information. And with that, I'd ask for the committee's support, your support.
Please state your name and
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. Just one quick follow-up on Representative O'Neill's question. We believe that the audits are going to be made much, much easier for all parties who are essentially users of the audits, whether that's the Commissioner of Administration or the legislative committees that have oversight over these matters. Because of the fact that the log of use, which very specifically shows how the devices are utilized on a day-to-day basis, is included as part of the audit materials that are received, as well as the policies and procedures, which gives you a very good indication of whether the police agency, has put in place practices that comply with the statute. So we think that from a practical standpoint, this really does help everybody, including the commissioner.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just to that point, I don't remember seeing this on fiscal notes before, but they're actually charging $14,000 for a part-time person for rent, furniture, phone, IT equipment. It's very odd. And maybe I'm missing something, but it just seems a little bit off, especially as Chair Scott described, that this is actually going to make things easier, not more difficult. So I don't know, maybe we need to ask M&B for an updated fiscal note after these amendments or something. It just seems strange.
Yeah, we'll take that into consideration.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I just had one other comment on the expense of the audits. And I don't think that the audit just from going, in the instance of the Minneapolis PD getting an audit from Ramsey County Auditor, I don't think the price is going to go up to $20,000. The positive thing about these audits, as far as expense goes, is the price is coming down because there are more people doing them. That's a good old competition sort of a thing. But and I understand law enforcement's concern over budgetary items. I absolutely do. And part of the conversation when these surveillance tools were brought on board was that if you're going to have the tool, you're going to have to, have the expense of storing the data and making having some public accountability. So that was really all I wanted to say. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Did somebody else want to speak on this? Please state your name and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Lori Bartopensky, Acting Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Administration, and I would like to be able to address the fiscal note and representative's question about it. Our fiscal note, the standard process for fiscal notes includes furniture costs and costs to have a staff person, and the fiscal note lists the expertise needed as someone with auditing experience, and we have estimated it at a 0.5 FTE. So we'd have to have somewhere to put the person. So that is the nature of the fiscal note. Representative Scott has added a lot of good clarity in this bill. She has also increased the responsibility from the department from getting one letter that says audit was good, you're compliant, to having us review full, more extensive audits. So we really believe that we're able to address the data practices questions. We're lawyers, not auditors, and that we really need someone with that auditing experience to really do this well.
Thank you. And with that, the bill will be laid over as amended.
Thank you, member.
Next is House File 3984, Representative Crescia. And the chair will move House File 3984 for possible inclusion. We do have the A1 amendment, and I will move that as well. I believe it's the A1 is to get the bill in the way the author intends.
That is correct.
All those in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is approved. Representative Crescia, go ahead with your bill.
And, Mr. Chair and members, if you'll indulge me for one more, I do have a slight oral amendment, if I could ask for this, and this is on line 3.16. There was an oversight in the drafting that I missed, which is after the word record, we want to insert the word or, so it should read... must be an express waiver made voluntarily, and then 3.16, intelligently and on record or in writing.
Everybody understand that oral amendment? Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The oral amendment is adopted. Go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. This is a refinement of a bill that we passed last year, known more commonly as McKenna's Law, but the bill that we passed last year was just to seek clarification that children who become 10 or older in the child protection system are notified of their right of counsel. And it's in law that those children have a right to counsel, and we were... The bill's intent last year was just to make sure that was clear and to make sure that social service agencies were part of that process if need be. Since that time, while the intent of the law I thought was very clear and simple, it has been interpreted in some counties differently and I won't say incorrectly, just differently. And so we're seeking to clear that up. A couple of things that I have heard as I travel around the state and talking about this is some counties were automatically assigning counsel. Other counties were bringing children in and reading petitions. And all that we were trying to do, and I believe the intent of, and I believe this change and the amendment will get us closer to that, is we just want to make sure that these children know that they have the right to counsel. We have a very complicated system when a child moves into this situation, and we always want to make sure that that child has somebody looking after their interests. And I realize part of this problem is, which I believe others are addressing in this committee, but the guardian ad litem, and making sure that is shored up and making sure that that advocate is strong coming out of the judicial side. But we also want to make sure that we adhere to what's in statute about children having access to an attorney. And so we're just trying to clear all that up and try to fix a couple of things in that, and that is the bill, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we could talk a little bit about the A1 amendment that goes to or on a pro bono basis. Is there any requirement that you're adding anywhere that requires the pro bono lawyer to actually be qualified to do this service? Because I know there is a group of pro bono lawyers that are very qualified to do it, but I want to make sure that the court is appointing qualified pro bono attorneys, not just anyone who volunteers to do it.
Representative McCrecia?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, thank you for the question. There, nothing that I'm aware of addresses that specifically, and I believe that situation exists now, that we have nothing that actually says they have to be of a certain qualification state. Perhaps that's something we should consider and look at adding. I just had not had that presented to me before.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just right now they're entitled to a public defender.
Agreed.
And the public defenders are trained and qualified to do this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And the public defender's got no money to do this. And if we're giving the option for pro bono lawyers to be presented, representing these kids, they either have to be qualified or maybe come through an organization that trains them. Or we have to do something, because otherwise these folks are entitled to qualified representation.
Representative Crescia?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hillstrom. I don't want to get too far out into the deep end on this, but I believe part of the reason we're addressing this here is that that is already happening. I know there are pro bono attorneys that are doing some of this work, and we're also trying to make it clear that counties may not have to carry the whole brunt of this. We're trying to address a shortfall in funding, and we're trying to make all the options work, but I hear what you're saying, and I've made a note. I will revisit that. That's a good, very good suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pilster, you might want to check 3.3 in the bill that might be covered.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, did you say
3.3? 3.3, that is
3.4.
3.3.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Representative
Considine? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Crescia, as you know, I really like the bill a lot. However, this year I heard from the public defenders in the 5th Judicial District that we're being swamped with this, and there was no additional money given to the public defenders. They were just having this added on to what was already their caseloads. And again, I think we heard from them that on average they were getting 10 minutes with their clients prior to this being added, and they were frankly a little bit in despair about the added work. Will there be something in addition being added to for some financial help for the public defenders? Is that part of the plan? Do you have some sort of relief plan for the public defenders? Because what I'm hearing in the 5th Judicial District is that this has just made their jobs overwhelming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Constantine. What in this bill made their job overwhelming? How did this increase their workload directly. What language could you specifically point to that made that happen?
Thank you. The extra workload. They are being assigned children 10 and above as part of their workload now that they did not have before. And so they are now, their caseloads went up dramatically. And there was no additional lawyers brought on board. There was no additional time put in for them. They are swamped, and they cannot keep up. And they are stressed out about it. And, yes, I mean, they came to me specifically about this, saying this was a huge burden. I mean, they believe in what you did. And, again, I was a big proponent of it also. But it increased their workload dramatically, and there were no additional funds that came with this extra work.
Would you like to respond? Yes, thank you. And thank you, Representative Constantine. The reason I ask and the reason I want to hone in on this, because remember, the law did nothing more than already state what was already out there. These children always have had access to attorneys. And the reason I bring this up, and I want to be very clear on this and understand, is we had 87 counties interpret this in different ways than that. I do not know what happened in the fifth, but I have heard stories all the way from county commissioners who said to me, we used to have discretion, you took that away. You never had discretion. I've heard in situations like yours, and the reason I want to get to this is county attorneys are saying, we are being assigned. This law never said we need to assign. All we ever said was notification. So while I think there's an element that we need to look at in what you've heard, I think this, that we as legislators also need to be clear and push back a little bit to say, how was this interpreted? I've heard counties where every kid was assigned a lawyer. That was not what the law said. I realize that there is a CYA approach, but I think that is a collective interpretation that is not good for what we were trying to do. All we were trying to do was give kids the notification. And I have addressed and said publicly that, yes, I am more than willing to fight for funding, and I will try to do that. But I will also be clear in saying that we have to make sure that we get the intent right, and that people actually understand what was happening. And what I have seen and what I'm responding to is counties that have interpreted this differently than the intent was laid out.
Okay. So I also just found out that, in double-checking, last year we had a significant increase in the public defenders. 40-plus new public defenders were funded in the bill last year.
Repeat that.
40-plus new public funding for 40-plus new public defenders was in the bill last year. That's what I was just informed. We can, if you want, we can double-check with the fiscal analyst.
That'd be great.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, the spreadsheets are laid out a little differently in what the governor's request was and what was actually funded in the conference committee bill, because some of the categories were condensed from several into one. But under the, there's a line item for caseload reduction, which is in the second year is $4.7 million, which should fund around 40 positions at the public defender's office.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in what year?
There were the first year there was 1.8, which should fund maybe around 15 in the first year, and then with the additional money for fiscal year 2019, there's an additional 25 on top of those, beginning say around June 30th or July 1st.
Next year.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that is separate from the raise allocation. That was simply a caseload reduction.
That is correct.
That's next year. Thank you.
Representative Constantine.
Thank you. And I hear what you're saying, Representative Crucia, but the practical aspect of what is happening in the field to the attorneys is they are being assigned these children, and they are getting them. I mean, when you notify the kids and say you're you are now entitled to a lawyer, and they say yes, then it falls on the public defenders, and they are responding. They're stepping up to the plate. So the practical aspect is that they are getting them on their caseload, and they are overwhelmed by that.
Mr.
So if I can help you with that funding, I'd be happy to.
Understood. Mr.
Representative Crescia.
And the point that I think we need absolute clarity on is we don't know that more kids are saying yes. What we do know is that courts are assigning more. And what I'm telling you is the law that we passed did not say that. That's a major distinction. I'm not saying that we still don't need to fight for kids' representation and figure this, but we need to be absolutely clear what the intended and unintended consequences have been. And I do not think that that has been clear. I've heard a lot of anecdotal things. And when I dig into it, what I find out is it's not exactly positioned to me the way the numbers bear out. I'm not saying we don't need to address it. What I'm saying is we need to know exactly what the problem is, and funding is part of that, but we need to know exactly what the problem is before we address it.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the good intentions that were behind what we did last year, but kind of regardless whether they were intended or unintended, there's still the consequences. That's still what's happening. And while I certainly appreciate Representative Considine's concern about the attorneys being overwhelmed, what I'm more concerned about is the children who have said, yes, I want a lawyer, and now may not be getting the quality of representation that they deserve and that is required. And so, you know, if it's data that we need, if we need to do some kind of study, if we need to, you know, I don't know what it is that we need to do, but I've certainly heard anecdotally as well that more attorneys are being assigned, and whether it's because they're misinterpreting the law or it's because now that we're forcing them to make sure they're asking that more attorneys are being assigned. Either way, if the children who've said, yes, I want an attorney, aren't getting the type of representation they really should have and deserve to have in these proceedings, then we have to address it whether we meant for that to be the outcome or not. So, again, I'd be happy to work in getting the funding. I know there were some of us who brought this up last year as a potential consequence that we could see coming. So, you know, we can address this, and I think that we should. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The public defenders are here, and I'd really like to have them come down and talk about what the real consequences are and have been and what their funding pieces are so that we actually have the record clear on what it is. So, Mr. Chair, if you'd indulge me for a minute.
I would love to indulge you for that.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. Just to be clear, the funding last year in the conference committee report ended up with 12 additional public defenders statewide. And as I think we talked about with all of you last year, that didn't keep up with the growth in the number of cases that we had prior to the passage of McKenna's law. And as we have spoken with Representative Crescia and the other folks is, we are not opposed to this. These are our cases. We should be handling them. And I think Representative Considine, I think your 5th Judicial District Public Defenders indicated to you the same thing, which is these kids should be getting lawyers. At the time the bill passed, as we told Representative Crescia and others, is it's hard to know what you don't know. We didn't know how many kids were going through that system that didn't have lawyers. But there are places where we are seeing double, triple, even more of the number of kids going through that we are now representing. It's not everywhere, but it is places like the 5th District, the 7th District, the 8th District. So, and some of that has to do with the interpretation of the law. But
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you tell me how many new public defenders you will have in the next fiscal year? We're hearing that it is going to be 40.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, we added those 11 or 12 staff positions in January. That's it for the next for this biennium.
So 12 new public defenders were $4.7 million?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know where the 4.7 is. The rider in the conference committee report indicated there was $1 million right around that to hire 12 additional new public defenders.
And there's supposed to be another 25 this next biennium.
No, Mr. Chairman, there's only those 12.
Now, we will look into that because according to the information we have, there's supposed to be another 25 this next biennium, or this next year of the budget.
Mr. Chair, I think they'd love to have them, so I hope we can find them.
If it was allocated and they didn't get it, I want to know where it went.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
I already addressed. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Okay. I've been waiting to call your name to wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the only way I'll get a happy birthday is if we're in special session in September. So hopefully that won't happen. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Krisha, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking that, you know, part of the intent of the bill was so that these children would be informed of their right to have counsel and an attorney. And yet what is happening now, it appears that many children are saying yes. And you're saying that the bill doesn't require the counties to provide the attorneys to just inform them, but, you know, I mean, that pretty much means if they say yes, the counties have to provide that. So to say that it's a difference in the interpretation of the law, I think is sort of a little bit disingenuous. You know, you said that they were already required in the law to add that clarity, and now they're actually doing it. So, I mean, we need to have money. We need to have more money for these kids so they can have legal representation, and I hope that in the near future we'll see a bill put forward that will actually allot the substantial amount of money so the representation for these kids, because I think it's really, really important that these young children have access to legal representation, and when you inform a child or an adult that they have right to legal representation, I mean, that's a pretty key component in our justice system. So to say that the counties are misinterpreting it, I don't think that's true. I think they're interpreting the exact way that it was intended to be put in place so that these kids would have representation. So can we see a bill soon for more money for public defenders for these kids?
Mr. Chair, can I respond?
One moment. Mr. Waltz needs to make a clarification.
Mr. Chair and members, just to clear up some confusion, that was my mistake. I have two spreadsheets in my packet. One is from two biennium ago where they received the $4.7 million. That was in fiscal year 17. For 18 and 19, they received $1.5 total.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was closer to my recollection, as when the bill started, it had a cut of 58 public defenders. And so the fact that we held on to those 58 and got, a dozen or so more is more like my recollection.
Thank you. Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dean, and I have to respectfully disagree for a second. First of all, I don't believe you're actually suggesting that I was, my motives were disingenuous. But I need to be very clear on this, because this is a very complicated system we're dealing with. We all agree that more public defenders is a good answer. And I say a good answer not because I say it's the right answer. And we agree, and I would support and have supported more funding in that realm. I also support more funding for guardian ad litem. I'm also working on more funding for a training academy to train more social workers. And the reason I bring this up, and the reason this is so important, and you hear the conciseness in my language, perhaps, is I do not believe we can say with certainty that more kids are saying yes to attorneys. That may or may not be true, but I don't believe that's what's causing this. I can tell you with certainty that certain judicial aspects have been interpreted differently. Judges have interpreted this differently. I've heard them. I've seen the cases. The law never said we had to automatically appoint an attorney. And judges are doing that in some counties to every case. That was never the intent of the law. And that's very clear. Now, I'm not saying they're wrong or right. What I'm saying is our law didn't cause that. The reason I bring this up is because if every kid is being now appointed an attorney, whether they want it or not, that's a cost that I need to know that, because just throwing more attorneys at it isn't going to fix it. The other side of this is we have more children entering into the system, and why is that? And we have more children being taken out from homes. Why is that? We just had Representative Moran and Senator Hayden give a press conference talking about what are the gates to preventing children from being removed from the home and going through the removal system, because there are issues there. My point is we have to know more. We can't just go by that phone call where someone says, I'm hearing this happen. Because as I dig into those, the elements of what we're hearing is not the same as to what's actually happening. I had county commissioners, many of them, who said to me, before your law passed, we had discretion on whether or not we could give kids attorneys. And I said, you never had that discretion. My law never changed that. All we said was kids had to be notified because they weren't being notified. And I'm being very intentful on this, because if we're going to solve this, we really need to know what's going on. We really need to know what's happening, because the kids are being put in the shadows and adults are doing things for them that aren't always the best. And that, I think, we have to get our hands around. And that's a very difficult problem. One that we're not going to solve in this room, but I can tell you one that I spend about 180 sleepless nights on every year.
Representative Dean?
So maybe, Mr. Chair and Representative Kershaw, disingenuous was maybe not the most appropriate word. But what I would say is one of the sort of, I think, easily assumed impacts of having more children now being informed that they have a right to an attorney, that there would be more children requesting an attorney now. And that's irrespective of what you're hearing from where counties are assigning every, you know, child an attorney. So I think there is a correlation between those two. And I think that we need to know that we're funding the types of things that are going to resolve a lot of these issues, but we also need to fund the things that are going to prevent these issues. And I think that we often get caught up here is we're more than happy, or not happy, but we're more than willing to fund things after the fact, but we're very unwilling oftentimes to fund things to help prevent these types of things. We know that, you know, Protecting Families Act that Representative Moran and Senator Hayden put forward, you know, talk not only about the need in the African American community, but how a system seems to move people quickly into out-of-home placements that's at a much, much, like four times the rate for African American families than for typical Caucasian families in Minnesota. So it's, I agree with you. It's not funding just one thing. I agree funding guardian ad litems is important, and doing many other things, because we have to utilize all these tools. But I think that, you know, we need to assume that if we're going to be informing children of their right to counsel, that there will be more need for attorneys in that process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Any last? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just going to make one a little more political statement. I went to a CLE at William Mitchell College of Law talking about how we keep children from this system, and the national researcher informed us that for every dollar an hour we raise the minimum wage, we reduce the number of children in the child protection system by 10%. So there is one solution.
Any last comments on your bill, Representative Fisher.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you, and thank you for the robust discussion. I think it was important.
Thank you. With that, the chair will lay the bill over as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Keel. Members, we have about seven bills left in about 40 minutes.
That's you're still going really fast, Mr. Chair, right?
I'm hoping to. the House moves House File 3296 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Keel.
Mr. Chair, is it possible? I have two amendments and would like to pass those before we go through the entire bill.
That's what we I was hoping to do. Which one would you like first?
Let's just do them in order, A2.
The A2 amendment. That is, looks like a... You want to explain that briefly or...
I would love to. Members, this is to add more people to the working group. I wanted to make sure representation was clear and was not just in one area of Minnesota. Minnesota is a large state, and this addresses vulnerable adults, and we have vulnerable adults in every corner of Minnesota. But I would like to make sure that the representation is adequate for this working group as we move forward to help take care of vulnerable adults that are seeing some serious crimes, injury to them or their families.
Okay, any questions on the A2 amendment? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, can you tell me why you don't, from what I can tell, have any legislators sitting on this panel?
Representative Keel.
I don't. That's correct. I did add it to the other working group. It isn't that we can't. We can certainly consider that.
All those in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Then we have the A3 amendment. Representative Keel on the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A3 amendment really kind of gives direction to the expanded working group to identify the problem areas for providers when hiring and dealing with staff that have committed crimes. I know there's some question about it. It's actually a duty of the working group, and as we have heard testimony throughout this discussion of vulnerable adults, we have discovered that the providers are finding it very difficult sometimes when they're hiring somebody. They're in desperate need of employees. It isn't addressing of it is not quick enough for them. Sometimes they'll hire somebody thinking that they have someone that doesn't have a background in a maltreatment or a drug abuse or something of that sort. And they want to be able to know when they're hiring them that they are safe to put in that situation for caring for a vulnerable adult. So very important. I do know it has some challenges, though. I am fully aware that we have to be careful for the rights of the employee, too, and that becomes part of the problem. I myself have a PCA business owner that is a quadriplegic that often calls me about the different rules to try and make sure we safely put caregivers in that role, but also need to make sure that they don't have backgrounds. The background checks become cumbersome.
Any questions on the A3 amendment? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A3 is adopted. Representative Keel, go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Basically, this is a portion of the OLA report and addressing the vulnerable adult situation with the not addressing the OHFC, or the Office of Health Facility Complaints, not having such a backlog and not addressing the crimes and the challenges that are happening for our vulnerable adults. And I probably shouldn't even use challenges. It is some serious
problems that they are having, maltreatment, abuse of all kinds, financial, physical, sexual, neglect. This is to help address this issue. The working group, I'm hoping, can bring all of the stakeholders together to get a clear and concise recommendation for the legislature as we move forward. Hopefully the report will be in January. That's my intent. I did talk to the Office of Justice, OJP. What does that stand for again? Okay. Anyway, I did talk to them. We did do a fiscal statement on that, and that is to manage that working group. That is the funds for that, I believe. Was it 39,000. Yeah, 39,000 to manage that. And hopefully, I'm really hoping that the next legislature comes back in January with the group comes back with recommendations for the legislator that we can handle immediately. So.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, I'm very supportive of doing this. I think that you've done a good job of laying out who should be on there. I actually prosecuted cases of financial exploitation of vulnerable adults when I was a prosecutor. I do think it's important that you add people from the legislature. You have people from the administration. You have law enforcement. You have people from the private sector. Members, there are political realities that these bodies deal with, both the House and the Senate, and I think that at least having someone representing the legislature is important if they're going to be making recommendations to the legislative body. And so I would just encourage you, between now and the time this becomes law, to consider adding members of the House and Senate from the one from the majority, one from the minority, appointed by the Speaker and the Minority Leader.
Mr. Chair, I did do that with the other bill, so we certainly can do that.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Anyone from the audience wish to speak on this bill? Okay. With that, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Lesh, House File 3677.
Mr. Chair, which bill is this?
It's 2309 or 3677.
3677.
Okay, thank you.
The chair will move the bill, House File 3677, for possible inclusion. I believe you also have an amendment for that.
I do, Mr. Chair. I have a, pardon the cliche, peace in the valley amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A2.
Okay. Well, any questions on the A2? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Lesh, go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could have my testifiers come up. While they're coming up, Mr. Chair, it's been, I sat on this committee for 12 years, and I see that in the time that I've left, that you guys have taken a very deliberative approach to each and every issue, leaving no stone unturned. So I appreciate that. So I'm just going to do a little panorama, including the page here, of my old home where I spent so much time. And with that, you want to go ahead, Ms. Jonas? This, I will just begin, Mr. Chair, and say that this is in response to a court issue. This bill, the compensation for exonerated individuals, passed unanimously in the House in 2014. And I think there was one dissenting vote in the Senate. Am I right?
It was actually two dissents in the House and none in the Senate.
Okay. Well, pretty much everybody agreed that this is a good idea. And then the Supreme Court came and said, it was an interesting opinion if anyone's ever read the opinion. I mean, they decided it. I don't know. I'm not going to diss the Supreme Court, Mr. Chair, but we're going to fix it here. And everyone agrees to the fix. Peace in the Valley. Go ahead, Ms. Jones.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Lesh. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Representative Lesh said, in 2014, the legislature passed the Minnesota Imprisonment and Exonerations Remedies Act. The point of the bill was to offer state-funded compensation to people who had been in prison in Minnesota who were actually innocent for that crime and were released from prison. Since that time in 2014, only three people have been compensated, and that is exactly what we thought would be the result. This is an extremely limited remedy for an extremely limited group of people. And so the law has functioned as we expected to, but we have encountered some hurdles and found some areas where we need to clean up. They basically come in three areas. The first was mentioned by Representative Lesch. The Supreme Court last year in 2017 in a decision, State v. Dana Bach, found that we had created an equal protection violation by creating an impossible act in a certain group of select cases. This was not the intent of the bill. I should have introduced myself, Julie Jonas with the Innocence Project of Minnesota. We worked very closely with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association in getting this passed in 2014. What we had created was certainly not a result that was intended, but what the Minnesota Supreme Court did in order to correct that was eliminate a significant portion of the bill, which then would eliminate compensation for a significant number of people, including all three of the exonerees who had already gotten compensation. So that is the first problem that we seek to correct today. The second problem is to tighten up the definition of consistent with innocence. We've been in discussions with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and what they have explained to us is there has been a number of claims that have come through this process into the district court where people are requesting compensation when their conviction was overturned on a purely technical ground and not necessarily based on factual innocence. That was not the intent of this bill. None of those cases have made it past the district court. However, it has been a drain on resources for the various county attorneys where these cases have been brought. So we've developed a stronger or a definition of consistent with innocence in a hope to eliminate those claims that we did not intend to be compensated but still allow those who are factually innocent to get compensation. And then we've also had just several technical fixes that were suggested to us by members of the legal community. I'm here to answer questions that you have, but I did bring a couple of members of the public with me to testify today. The first person I'd like to introduce to you is Kua Lee. If you want to come up. Okay. Some of you may remember Kua Lee either from 2014 when the bill was passed, 2016 when he ultimately received his compensation, or from his case when it made headlines in 2010 and 2011. Mr. Lee was convicted of criminal vehicular homicide when his Toyota malfunctioned and hit another car. Three people in that car would die. There was no indication of any drug or alcohol use. He didn't even have a cell phone, so it wasn't an inattentive driving situation. He was simply accused of being a bad driver because the state believed his foot was on the gas instead of the brake. With that, he was sent to prison after he was convicted by a jury in Ramsey County. Later, when the Toyota recalls came, we, along with a large, significant group of lawyers and a lawyer from Texas, were able to bring his case back into court, and he was ultimately exonerated. Mr. Lee spent almost 3 years in prison, and during that time, when he went to prison, he had a child who was 1 year old. His wife was pregnant with another child. Neither of those children knew who he was when he got out. We were very grateful to this legislature for passing this bill and enabling him to get compensation that really has helped his family move forward from the injustice done to them. And I just wanted to have Mr. Lee be able to speak for a minute about what that's meant to them.
Mr. Lee, welcome to the committee. If you could please keep it short, because we still have a bunch of bills to go to get done today. So if you please keep it very brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kua Fong Lee, and I was wrongfully convicted of vehicular homicide in 2007 after my Toyota Camry accelerated uncontrollably at the end of the freeway exit ramp in St. Paul. So our car crashed into two vehicles and ultimately killing a man and two children. After spending 2 years and 9 months and 24 days in prison, Toyota revealed that some of his car were experiencing acceleration issues. And the Innocent Project helped my team of lawyers proof that my car malfunctioned, causing it to accelerate and crash. I spent nearly 3 years in prison before I was exonerated and released. And during this time, I missed the birth of my youngest child. It broke my heart to miss this important moment in my family's life. And my wife and I have 4 young children. And when I was released from prison, my children did not know who I was. And the 2 oldest had lost touch with me, and the 2 youngest did not know me at all. And it took a long time for me to earn their trust and build my credibility as a father. But today, I'm proud to say that on the fall of 2016, I had graduated with my social work degree. My time in prison set me back many years career-wise, but I'm working as hard as I can to get my life back to where it was, so I will be the provider I want to be for my family. And nothing can buy the time that I spend away from my family, but the compensations I have received from the state of Minnesota will help a little bit. So I was be able to buy a beautiful house for my family because of that. And finally, I would like to say thank you for the compensation the state of Minnesota provided me and my family. And thank you so much.
Thank you. Next one. Okay. Next testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, we do have one other person to testify from the Innocence Project. She's a community member named Lori Ebensteiner, who's in strong support of this bill.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd be as brief as possible, the committee would appreciate it.
Yes, I will. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Public Safety Committee, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of House File 3677. My name is Lori Ebensteiner. Unlike many of my colleagues on the Innocence Project Board, I am not a lawyer. I'm here as a private citizen, and I've been a member of the board for about 2 years. I got involved with the Innocence Project because I'm deeply concerned about what a widespread and pernicious effect wrongful incarceration has on whole communities, and I wanted to see if I could do something to prevent it from happening. And let me be clear, I'm hardly a social justice warrior. Crime is a really serious problem in our community, but if you're guilty, I think you should be punished. But being in prison for a crime one did not commit, a story like Mr. Lee's, is one of the most tragic miscarriages of justice that can ever happen. And wrongful incarceration cuts a very broad swath. It afflicts whole communities, because if the wrong person is sitting behind bars for that crime, it means that the real criminal is at large, and that threatens everyone living in that community. So none of us is truly immune. As a board member over the last couple of years, I've gotten to know people like Mr. Lee, and I've seen at close range how shattering an experience like wrongful incarceration is to their lives, and not just their lives. It's their friends and their family and their coworkers and their neighbors. And I've come to see what a truly Herculean task it is for an innocent person that's been in prison for a crime he or she did not commit to reclaim their dignity and try to live a normal life after they've languished in prison for years, and sometimes it's many years. Our justice system is arguably the best in the world, but we know it's not perfect. We know it's not pristine.
sometimes terrible mistakes are made, and it's really no one's fault. And grave injustices like wrongful incarceration happen to innocent people like Mr. Lee. But when they happen, we have to act swiftly and surely to take corrective action, to restore integrity to the system so that we can all count on it, and to ensure that the wrongfully accused, people like Mr. Lee, have at least an opportunity to become productive citizens again. So the 2014 compensation for exoneree statute was an effort to do just that. The Innocence Project feels very strongly that it was the right thing to do, and as Ms. Jonas said, we were so gratified that our lawmakers agreed with us and passed it into law. However, the subsequent modifications, as Ms. Jonas talked about, have some serious and unintended consequences for our exonerees, and we're asking you to help rectify this, please. The changes that we're asking are modest but highly meaningful, and they're entirely consistent with the spirit of the original law. So please help us do the right thing again. Please act to preserve the intent of that legislation for the benefit of the victims of wrongful incarceration so that they can resume their lives. I sincerely hope we can count on your support, and thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Any questions from the members? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. I just want to thank especially Mr. Lee for taking the time and to share his testimony. I think it's a good reminder in this committee about the work we do here every day, about the gravity of what it means to incarcerate a person and take away their most basic freedom, and the real effects that has on an entire family, an entire community. So I hope everyone was really listening to Mr. Lee's testimony, because it relates to everything we do here as far as increasing penalties and a lot of things we talk about with the criminal justice system. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Anyone from the public wish to testify? Mr. Small.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Robert Small. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I just wanted to thank Representative Lesh for bringing this bill forward, and I want to give some particular thanks to the Innocence Project and the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, with whom we worked on a very important issue to all of us, and that was defining or refining the definition of on grounds consistent with innocence. We worked hard at doing that. We were able to come to agreement on that, and I just wanted to let everybody know that the County Attorneys Association appreciates that and supports this bill as amended.
Thank you. Representative Lesh, any last remarks?
I just say, Mr. Chair, you know, it seems like every year in the last eight, I've had at least one or two bills to modify and correct Supreme Court decisions. Today I have two before you in the same committee, and when those decisions come out, a lot of times there are folks on each side, and I want to commend the Innocence Project and proponents, as well as the County Attorney's Association, for coming together on this, because it wasn't easy when we passed it back in 2014. It was very sensitive, and I'm not going to get into all the things that happened back then. I'm not going to relitigate that, but there was some I think soreness left, and the fact they were able to get together and talk this out and reach the language that they did in the amendment is how we should be doing business around here. So I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, the bill will be laid over. Next, we have House File 2309, Representative Lesh. The chair will move 2903 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my testifier has come down. I'll start off on this. This bill, as I stated before, as well as another one correcting a court decision, as things have stood, our intention to create the tracking warrants when we did back in 2014, this was from 2014 as well, Mr. Chair. This actually, I had this bill, but there were two versions. This bill was actually Joe Atkins' bill that was worked on with Rich Neumeister at the time. It was our intention to make public the results of these tracking warrants. Well, what happened was when these tracking warrants went before a judge for a warrant, they included in their petition for the warrant and the fact basis everything together, And judges, well, stated that they did not know how to separate that which should remain sealed under statute and that which this body has had decided would become public after 90 days. So they, by default, said, well, it's all not public. Well, that frustrated a lot of people. And over the course of the time, I had conversations with the judiciary as well as Ben here, Mr. Feist, and I think we've reached a good compromise on this. There are some folks that would like us to push farther on this, but in speaking with the BCA, I think we've reached a reasonable compromise on what the intent originally was. And if we want to go further, I would bring that up, but we're not going to do that in this bill. We're going to fix the court problem in this bill.
Mr. Feist, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ben Feist, Legislative Director of the ACLU of Minnesota. Thank you again for hearing this bill. Again, it's a simple fix, as Representative Lesh mentioned. It was clearly the intent that we wanted to know as the public and, again, through this body, exactly what was happening with tracking warrants in Minnesota once this new law went into effect in 2014. We had some concerns about just how widespread was that law enforcement was trying to check up on where someone's cell phone was at any point. And we weren't sure if that was happening five times a year or 5,000. So it was really important that we get a level of accountability and transparency with this practice because, again, this can be a big invasion of privacy potentially. And if someone's location was tracked, eventually they should be given notice of that in one way or another. And there are concerns that that was not happening based on the interpretation under the original language of the bill. So hopefully this corrects everything. We are in support, and as Representative Lesh said, we certainly could go further and make some other modifications, but at this time I think this is a simple fix and a good step forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Any one in the audience wish to testify on this bill? Representative Lesh, any last words?
No, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The chair will lay the bill over. Possible inclusion. Representative Ward. Representative Ward, I'll let you move your bill for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the committee. I move House File 4140 for the committee's consideration.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I really appreciate your taking the time to work through this with us. I have a couple of testifiers here who bring wisdom and experience to this challenging issue. We all heard a lot about this, particularly around the big sports events, but this is not something that's just limited to that. And so I would like to introduce I'll have our testifiers introduce themselves, but I do want to mention that both of them are award-winning in their fields as an analyst and as a prosecutor, and an investigator and prosecutor in trafficking. And I will let them introduce themselves and then provide their testimony.
Welcome to the committee. I do ask that we are a little short on time, that we could be as much information as you can in as brief a time as possible. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amy Schroeder, and I'm the Criminal Intelligence Analyst at the Washington County Attorney's Office, and I'm assigned to the East Metro Sex Trafficking Task Force. I'm here to support this bill because purchasing a human being is wrong, immoral, and illegal. When I started, we quickly learned that commercial sex had moved from street-based prostitution to online through various websites and cell phone applications. Victims of trafficking do not identify as victims. They likely will not call law enforcement for help. It was essential that in order to identify victims, someone needed to be tasked with combing through each of these websites and phone applications. When I started that, I began to identify victims and provide that information to law enforcement. I was able to identify potential traffickers from social media accounts linked to the advertisements. From 2016 to 2017, in Washington County, we provided over 100 tips to law enforcement, which led to arrest and prosecution of 23 sex traffickers and recovered dozens of victims. While doing this, I realized the demand for commercial sex was significant, and in order to slow this problem, something needed to be done on the demand. We have partnered with several law enforcement agencies to conduct sting operations where law enforcement would pose as a minor to solicit prostitution. I am proud to say these operations led to several arrests. Although the names, ages, and locations of the suspects changed, one thing that never did was the volume. In 2016 and in 2017, every day I went online to the website that many of you have heard of before, Backpage.com, to count the numbers of advertisements. Although not scientific, we wanted to get a grasp of the amounts of ads for commercial sex that were posted online. Although Backpage.com is shut down now, here is some of the data that we did observe. I was expecting to count a few hundred each month, but what I found was staggering. Remember, this is just one website, and it was just counting from the Twin Cities area. In 2016, there was 74,273 commercial sex advertisements posted. And in 2017, there was 99,968 commercial sex advertisements posted. In January 2017, Backpage shut down their adult section, and we thought the numbers would decrease. However, they just moved under the dating and the massage sections. This further illustrates the point that even if it shuts down, the demand is high, that it'll just move to a different website. As you are aware, some sites like Backpage.com and Craigslist.com shut down. However, for those involved in this work, we know that this would not end the problem. We have several websites already that we're looking into. There's new websites and phone applications that are coming up every day that we're looking into. We have dozens of people convicted of soliciting commercial sex from minors in Washington County. These people are our grandparents, parents, brothers, uncles, co-workers, neighbors, and friends. The victims of commercial sex are children, parents, grandparents, co-workers, neighbors, and friends. This bill sends a message that for those who purchase a human being, there are now serious penalties and consequences for their actions. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for hearing this bill. I truly appreciate your time. I will defer to Mr. Ali.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is Imran Ali. I'm a prosecutor in Washington County. I'm assigned to the East Metro Sex Trafficking Task Force. If I had a dollar for every time someone told me in the last few years working on trafficking cases, Imran, why are you so passionate? Why do you care so much? It's just prostitution. There's a quote. To treat prostitution as if it is not sexual exploitation is to assume that sexual dehumanization is the original human condition. To truly understand what those in law enforcement and prosecution around the state have been focused on, there has to be that very basic foundation that prostitution is sexual exploitation. There's no question about it. On the other side of prostitution, what we deal with every day is the sex trafficking of victims around this country, around this state, and particularly for me, in Washington County. We can talk about the demand, we can talk about the supply, and we know that the demand fuels the supply. But I just offer a glimpse into what a day in our office is like dealing with these cases. I prosecuted an individual last year who was a regional trafficker who trafficked his wife. Law enforcement discovered that prior to trafficking his wife, he trafficked his fiance. And prior to doing that in Anoka County, he also trafficked an ex-girlfriend. This is an individual who has a propensity to traffic other individuals. How did we know what he was like? Oftentimes we have to rely on what the victim says. But in this particular case, this trafficker actually recorded, set up a recording device on the cell phone that every time that this victim or his wife would go on these dates with these commercial sex work, or as we call them, Johns, it would be recorded. Ms. Schroeder had to go through every single one of those videos. And on those videos, not only did we see that, but we saw the ugly nature of what the relationship truly was. This was a victim who did not say she was a victim, who never believed she was a victim, but we heard it and we saw it in the videos. We saw the assaults and we saw the threats. It was advertised online and there were hundreds of sex buyers here locally. Another case that I prosecuted last year was an individual who had trafficked over 30 women across 32 states, including here in Minnesota. The hub of his trafficking operation was in Minnetonka. He trafficked these individuals. He profited off these individuals. He made them pay a choose-up fee, which was almost like an agency fee of $2,000 just to get on board with this criminal enterprise. There were hundreds and thousands of sex buyers that fueled that case. We asked one of the sex buyers, particularly, how much money did you make during this time? And she said, has to be over $1 million. That $1 million comes from people in our community. And lastly, an international case that I prosecuted last year, along with somebody you'll hear from, Ms. Kugler, involving not only just here locally, all around the state, and in different countries. And this particular individual would communicate with all the sex buyers while she was residing in the state of California. I can tell members of this committee and Mr. Chair that I have viewed the 44 cell phones in this case, and the demand shocked me beyond all belief. In one particular case in the city of Oakdale, while law enforcement was doing surveillance for 2 hours, 2 hours only, 9 men had received sex in exchange for money. 9 men. In one city. And remember, there was over 170,000 ads in the last 2 years. So this truly is an issue. I'm in support of this bill because what do all of those bad and the ugliness have in common? It's that the demand fuels this. The commercial ecosystem deals with the trafficker. It deals with the prostituted person, as we call them now, victims. And lastly, it deals with the demand. But for the demand, you wouldn't have the trafficker. The trafficker is doing it for the money. You wouldn't have the female who is involved in the system. It's all money driven, and the money comes from those customers. This is like anything else. When we wake up every day, we have risk benefit. We weigh, does the risk outweigh what the benefit is? We have that. We do it every single day, and those who commit crimes do the exact same thing. This is an enhancement bill that truly enhances the purchasing of a human being to a felony. You have one opportunity, and it's a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor, depending on where it's at. And if you do it again within that 10-year look-back period, it's a felony. We've seen it work, enhancements, DWI, probably one of the ones that no doubt about it works. I have this unique ability. I used to be a public defender, and now I'm a prosecutor. So I've defended people in Hennepin County, and now I've prosecuted people. And I've seen the way enhancements actually work. And we know they work because we have less felony DWIs than we have misdemeanor DWIs. So it truly is important, and I'm asking this committee and Mr. Chair that you take some of this passion. I'm going to leave with just 30 seconds on one number that I want everybody to leave with. 8,204. From 2016 and 2017, law enforcement around the state and many that are here in support of this bill today have been doing these sting operations where they communicate with people posing as if they are a minor. 8,204 unique suspects during this time were identified. They didn't do an advertisement every single day and they didn't do these stings. There were only 51 stings in those 2 years. But that's 8,204 times that somebody woke up and decided it was okay to purchase a human being. 8,204 times where someone started their day with this form of sexual exploitation, and 8,204 times when the benefits in their mind outweighed those risks. I know that all of you have so many important bills today throughout the session. I ask that this be one of those, or even just sex trafficking and human trafficking and protection of those victims, and really going after what's making this the problem, and that's the demand. I thank you so much for your time.
Representative Cox. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really don't want you to get graphic, but in these ads, are they written in code, or are they really just blatant in what they're asking for?
Ms. Schroeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Most of the ads have pictures and sometimes videos of the female.
That's
and then they also just say phone numbers. And
thank you.
Anybody from the audience? Oh, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Ward, for bringing this forward. This is terrific. It's good to see Ms. Trelli and Ms. Schroeder. I had a chance to work with them. I want to highlight a couple things for members real quick. We had the discussion, I think it was yesterday, about child pornography, and that when somebody's caught, it's many, many more times they're doing it. And that is absolutely the case for this as well. So, you know, the person's being caught that second time but would receive the felony. They've been doing it many, many, many times, although they pretty much all say, oh, this is my first time. But then, you know, we know that it's not. That's number one. Number two is I just want to denote in the language that's being modified, there's a reference to the person who's doing the buying, our felon here, as being a patron. There's some pretty ugly language in the prostitution trafficking statutes, and just to point out to the members that there's an effort right now taking a look at how we should be addressing the situation with adult victim survivors of prostitution trafficking, and I think there's a lot of interest in addressing the language that's in the statutes. And the final piece is just to say that the amazing work being done in Washington County has been funded and supported by the grants that the committee has pushed along. You know, you remember in 2015, I authored the grants to support local investigations of trafficking. Former Chair Cornish championed that. The committee was supportive of it, and it's continued on, including now. So it's our work been supporting the amazing work that they're doing. So many thanks to you and for bringing this bill forward.
Anyone from the public wish to testify on this bill? Okay. With Representative Ward, do you want to wrap up on this quickly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, I would like to thank the committee not only for hearing this bill but for giving the grant. As Representative Pinto mentioned, he's done a lot of work on this over the years and has helped us move this along. I've known Mr. Ali for a number of years through Washington County, but I actually got to meet both of them in a presentation to our community a few months ago. And that full presentation is profound. You just got a wink of it today. The stories, the work that they do is astounding, and I would very much appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you. With that, the chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion. One thing I wish they still did, and I checked what during the testimony, St. Paul PD used to post the pictures of all the Johns on their website. I wish they did that again. Let the people know who's doing this and who's buying these kits. Next, we have House File 3955, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This is an expansion of forfeiture vehicles for prostitution. So I'll let our testifier introduce herself and explain the details of it. I know that a lot of people have challenge with forfeiture laws, but we know that this works. So please proceed.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Kugler. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney. I'm also a designated prosecutor for the Minnesota Human Trafficking Investigators Task Force that is housed at the BCA. I have been working in sex trafficking, solicitation of prostitution, working with traffickers, victims, demand side buyers. I'm in my eighth year now of doing this work. I feel very strongly, very passionately, that we have got to stop all aspects have to be addressed. Everybody needs to be addressed, whether it be the buyers, the suppliers, the traffickers. But we have to address the demand, because without the demand, you're not going to have the opportunity for the traffickers to do their business and to exploit and sell human beings for sex, because that's what's going on. In the trafficking statute, specifically the solicitation of prostitution statute, right now there exists the ability to forfeit vehicles for buyers of sex. The way that the law is written at the current time is somewhat in controversy in terms of the way that it's interpreted by different counties and by different judges because of the state of the law. And the only thing this bill really does is clarify that. Right now, the law allows vehicles to be forfeited if used for the solicitation of prostitution, if it's used during the commission of the crime, to facilitate the crime, or to commit the crime. In other words, is the act occurring in the vehicle? Some counties say, that's all we need. We're going to forfeit the vehicles of these guys that are going out there to buy sex. Other counties say, no, because there's some Supreme Court, you know, there's a Supreme Court murder case in which a guy used a vehicle. He was a co-conspirator. He used the vehicle. He drove in the vehicle. He drove the tools that were used in the commission of the murder in the vehicle. But the vehicle itself wasn't used in the commission of the actual murder. And so because of that case, it clouds it somewhat. And then there are other cases where we do allow forfeiture. And so there's a distinction right now in the counties that are looking at this, and some counties are saying we're going after the vehicles, other counties aren't. We simply need to have this bill clarified so that there is no question that the vehicles can be forfeited if they're used in the commission of this crime. And that's all it's doing, is simply adding on if it's used in any way. Used in any way. These buyers travel, research shows, typically 30 to 40 to 50 to 60 miles to have sex, to pay for sex. They're not doing it in their own communities. They're not doing it in their own communities because of risk of exposure, fear that they're going to be found out, fear that they're going to be caught. So they don't typically do it in their own neighborhood. They're going to drive somewhere to do it, and they're going to pay to sexually assault minors. In many cases, men will drive much further to have sex with minors. And right now, the way the statute's written, we've got this disparity of some counties forfeiting vehicles and some not. Why would we not take away the central tool that these people use to get to the place where they're going to commit the crime? We need to cripple their ability to commit this crime. And one of the big things we can do is to forfeit the vehicles. That threat of punishment is a very, very strong motivation. Sex offenders' biggest, the buyers of sex, their biggest fear is exposure, and then they don't want to get hit financially. They're worried they're going to lose their job. They're worried they're going to lose their assets. Why would we not use that and take away their ability to drive to the place where they're going to sexually assault people? It's just critical that we do this. It's the law of any lawyer, and it's the law of the foundation of lawyers and the foundation of the legislature to clarify and make things very, very clear so there can be no ambiguity. As Justice Scalia once said, it's the main business in law to take out the romance, to take out the mystery, to take out the ambiguity. We've got to take out the ambiguity. Right now, the way the statute's written, there's ambiguity, and it simply needs to be clarified. This isn't a major overhaul. This isn't a big on the hot button forfeiture issue that's happening right now within the House, and I recognize that is a very, very major issue. This is a current issue, just a very simple clarification of a current law that is in place, and we just need to have that clarification so there is no question, so that we can have consistency in how we're dealing with these cases and what the consequences to the buyers of sex are. We have got to stop the sale of human beings for sex. We simply have to. The 8,204 number that Mr. Ali just gave you is a fantastic example of that. 8,204 men, primarily men, not all men, but predominantly men, were ready to get in their car and drive somewhere because they're responding to an ad. These aren't the people that are out on the street picking up somebody on a street corner. These are the people that are responding to an ad, which means they're going to get in their car and drive to the seller of sex to have sex, to buy that sex. It's got to be stopped. Please clarify the bill. Please make the change in the law. I ask that you support it. Thank you.
Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question would be for Representative Ward. So I appreciate, and actually was alluded by a testifier as well, the other conversation that's occurring right now in the body, the civil forfeiture. So I'm wondering if you can just help me understand then when these, trying to think of the nicest word that I can use, when these scumbags use either their wife's car or might be living in their grandma's house or something to that effect, when they use those vehicles to perform these acts, what are the implications, again, in the context of the other conversation regarding civil forfeiture that's occurring? Thank you.
Representative Ward, or
yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would, if one of the others would like to respond to that, or expand on what I can tell you about it. It uses the same language that currently exists, that if this is the only vehicle the family has to get to work, or it's the wife's car, and it would be a hardship for this car to be taken on other people, then there are exceptions that courts can make. Is that?
It is. It's the owner of the vehicle, and it is also the, like cars that are leased, for example. Mm-hmm. Those cars, unless they are leased for a period of in excess of 180 days, they're not subject to this. So there are protections, and as within any forfeiture currently as it's written, they can go forward, and if it's a hardship to members of the family, the judge can deny the forfeiture. It's not an automatic absolute, and certainly the discretion of the prosecutors would play into it as well, and the forfeiture attorneys on whether or not they're going to proceed in cases, for example, where you have I've got a person right now who's violated the law so many times. He's got so many prostitution convictions as it exists, and then he was picked up over the Super Bowl for trying to solicit a 15-year-old very intentionally, knew darn well exactly who this person was. It's a 62-year-old man, and he's just had no consequences but slaps on the wrist so far. We have to stop his ability to drive to these women to sexually assault them, which is essentially what it is.
We are trying to change behavior.
Representative Rankin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, or maybe to the testifier, my question is, what about the vehicle of the traffickers? I mean, is that already addressed somewhere in the law? Or, because I'm guessing with all this money, those have to be sometimes some very nice vehicles that we would like to take from them.
It is already addressed. This is just a clarification here.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I spoke out of turn. I apologize.
That's okay.
Question answered. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I do want to note on that, though, that's, you know, the commonality in buyers is they're virtually all men and they have money, right? Because it's the money that they're using to spend. And there's a lot of money sloshing through the system of traffickers, but then there's a lot of opportunistic. And it's surprising. I've been surprised that, like, you kind of think there's these kind of these massive pools of money that they have. Not necessarily, because it comes right on through. They spend it. They may be kind of doing it more opportunistically. So I guess I just want to make sure to emphasize that kind of when you think about the economics of the thing, it's the buyers, actually, because they have jobs, they have money coming in, and then this is one of the things that they're spending it on. Just make sure to make that comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any public testimony on this bill? Representative Ward, any brief last comments?
Only to say thank you. Both of these bills are ways to change the behavior that has become so much easier and part of our culture with the electronics availabilities. Most of you may know that I'm not inclined to increase penalties in this way. I would prefer to do restorative practices and things like that. But I've been assured by the professionals that this is the best way to attack this problem, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you. And with that, the chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Chair Johnson, welcome. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I'll move House File 3959 for possible, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. Go ahead with your testimony.
House File 3959 deals with distribution of surcharges by the Commissioner of Budget and Management working with the Post Board. And with that, I will let Nate Grove from the Post Board describe the bill real briefly.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for carrying this bill and members seeking your support. It's important in that essentially the bill increases the portion of the $75 traffic surcharge that's directed to the Post Board from 39% to 41%, or about 50 cents per surcharge transaction. And excuse me, I'm Nathan Gove, Executive Director of the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board. From these funds, the vast majority goes to individual peace officer training reimbursement, and it also goes to our operating budget as well. This is due to a longstanding decline in the surcharge revenues, and specifically a significant decline in year-to-date revenues from last year. There was a fiscal note that recently came out within the last several weeks, and I'm here to say that I appreciate the support of this going forward. I will need to return to the legislature as, at least based on the estimates of the fiscal note, it will still leave us in the next biennium at nearly a $300,000 deficit to the Post Board. So this is very important for the work that we do on behalf of peace officers and the profession of law enforcement throughout Minnesota. So I'm very appreciative, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any member questions? Anyone from the public wish to testify on this bill? Any further comments, Chair Johnson?
I just appreciate your support.
With that, we'll lay over House File 3959 for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, House File 4317, would you like to move that?
Members, I will move House File 4317 for be laid over for possible inclusion.
And you have testifiers?
We have one testifier today.
Would you like to introduce yourself? Oh, I'm sorry.
Members, this House File 4317 is actually a copy of House File 3338, which is in Health and Human Services Finance. This is an initiative by the Sheriff's Association to authorize use of low-dose X-ray body scanning devices for the purpose of scanning incoming inmates to the local jails for concealed weapons, drugs, communication devices, and other contraband that poses serious risk to the safety and security of jail staff and inmates. The Minnesota Department of Health regulates X-rays devices in use in Minnesota, and current laws appears to limit the use of these scanners for medical settings. The bill would authorize the use in the local and state correctional facilities and authorize rulemaking authority for the Department of Health to regulate these devices, and in addition to those in the medical facilities. With me today is Commander Dave Patchell of the Anoka County Sheriff's Office to give the committee some additional testimony.
Welcome to the committee, Commander, if you want to introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Patchell. I'm a commander at the Anoka County Jail, and I oversee jail operations. As stated, this is simply to give us another tool in our arsenal to prevent contraband introduction into jails. When I started 30 years ago, frankly, contraband wasn't a big issue for us. It didn't happen very often. Attempts to smuggle it in were very non-sophisticated, and we caught most of it. That's not the case anymore. People are willing to go to much greater lengths to smuggle in drugs. They're becoming increasingly more sophisticated in their attempts, and we're seeing a huge spike in the attempts. In my jail within the last 2 weeks, we've caught people that despite our best efforts, good policy, good intakes, video, metal detectors, that have managed to smuggle drugs inside of our facility, and they're doing it in a unique way. They're smuggling it inside their bodies. There is nothing we have in our current arsenal that will detect that. This bill will give us the tools we need to literally see if they're smuggling drugs in that way. It creates a huge liability for us when they smuggle these type items in, and it goes directly against our duty to protect the public, the people in custody, and the people who are incarcerated. By supporting this bill, we will be able to use low-dose scanners like they use at the airport. They're very similar. And like they currently use in the federal prisons in Minnesota. It simply just gives us the ability to use that. Our partners at the Department of Health will help oversee development of procedures so that they're used safely and only within the narrow scope of our jobs. Thank you.
Thank you. Any member questions? Any public testimony? Chair Johnson, any final words?
I just want to thank the committee for hearing this. About 2 weeks ago, I talked to Commissioner Roy. They are very much interested in using these. They had an incident at the Shakopee Women's Prison a couple weeks ago where a large amount of meth was smuggled into the prison. They believe as well that this type of equipment will stop that. So with that, I thank you for your support.
Thank you. And House File 4317 will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.
Nice.